All right. Hi, guys. This is Amber. I am joined with special guest Ben Fogel. He is a contributing editor to Jacobin, Africa is a Country. He has a new article out in Catalyst, and he is on a wonderful podcast called Auf Bunga Bunga. Please do not judge it for its stupid German portmanteau name. I made an appearance and will link to that along with all of his articles as well.
Yes. I'm normally based in Brazil, but I'm back in New York for a few weeks.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. However, it's probably not good to be there right now.
Yeah, I mean, it might just be the most depressing place in the world, but at least it isn't cold.
Yeah, well, there's that. So I guess to start, I think people who listen to us are aware that something bad is happening in Brazil. So could you catch us up on, let's say, recent, maybe not so recent Brazilian politics?
Okay, well, I'll try to be as brief and precise as possible.
Yes, if you could consolidate your Catalyst article, Brazil's Never-Ending Crisis, in 3 minutes.
Well, I mean, the first rule I think about Brazil is that things can always get worse. And right now, this Sunday, Sunday the 28th, there is the second round of Brazil's presidential election, which has been the most traumatic and messed up election in since the country returned to democracy in 1985. And this Sunday, as you may or may not know, there is a man called Jair Bolsonaro who will be elected, almost certainly short of some sort of unforeseen miracle or a comet hurtling down from space, as Brazil's next president. And Bolsonaro, I think, can fairly be described as a fascist or neo-fascist. Unfortunately, as I think many American listeners and listeners from Europe may know, the word fascism has been degraded by overuse. It's like the boy who cried wolf. People have said the fascists are coming so many times that people kind of get weary and cynical when the wolf actually pops his head up. In the case of Bolsonaro, I think it's an accurate description. Among other things, he's a former army captain who has ridden a tidal wave of anti-systemic anger, anger at the left, rage about violence and corruption and economic crisis, to basically say that the problem with Brazil is that the left is there. There's all these internal enemies. It's the left. It's the working class. It's the gays. It's the woman. It's the black people. It's all of these things, and what we really need is a return to authoritarian values and to shoot our way out through the out through this crisis. And he's basically saying that I love the military dictatorship. I love torture. Torture was great during the military dictatorship. Oh, my sons go around wearing his T-shirt. I go around waving the book of Ustra, who's one of the most infamous torturers of Brazil's military dictatorship, who, among other things, used to put rats in women's vaginas. And this is Bolsonaro's hero.
Jesus.
He's also, his main criticism of the dictatorship was it didn't kill enough people. And he's also beloved by the business community because he's outsourced his entire economic program to a Chicago school-trained economist who got his start working for Pinochet back in the day. Kind of nostalgia vibe, right? Back to the 70s. Anyway, he basically, his economic program is privatize everything, cut all social spending. His way to deal with Brazil's extremely deep security problems, 64,000 people were killed last year in Brazil. At least 5,000 of those were by the police, is to say, let's get rid of all human rights. And all these fucking human rights NGOs, and let the police do what they want. So he's literally advocating social cleansing of poor communities as a way to deal with violence. And more than that, he's also saying that I don't accept democracy. I've never been a fan of it. That he said, and this is obviously in English, but it's kind of verbatim, I'm going to unleash a historic cleansing in Brazil, and those red bandits, obviously referring to supporters of the Workers' Party and the left, will either have to be banished or put in prison. And he said other times, I will end all activism. And basically, he's riding a wave of support, which also includes elements in the military. The military has a faction behind him, which includes several top generals and ex-commanders of, say, the Brazilian armed forces in Haiti, and they're behind him. He has the support of the business community. And what's basically, Brazil is like this sort of surreal place right now, because it feels like almost like Weimar Republic Germany, in that basically there's all this like rage against the left. Mm-hmm. And they had a center-left party which was in power under...
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about Lula and the stuff that led up to this?
So Lula is from the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party is kind of like a unique thing in Latin America. It's probably the last social democratic party of the classical model, like the German Social Democratic Party or the Labour Party. It came out of Brazil's trade union movement, but it was created in the 1980s. It was sort of bucked the trend. It was sort of out of place. And it enjoyed when it was Latin America's strongest working class movement, perhaps the strongest in the Western Hemisphere at the time. And it was also aligned to these huge, powerful social movements, particularly of people fighting for land in the rural areas, the sort of feminist movement, the gay movement, the urban movement. And it was really strong, but it was very radical, and it played a role in the end of the dictatorship. But it had one great leader who led a series of huge wildcat strikes in the ABC region, which is kind of like the most industrialized region in Sao Paulo. It's kind of like being in, like, I guess, like Detroit, okay. the car industry was. Yeah. Here. And he, in the United States, that is, he came to the fore and is kind of a unique political figure. He's a complete political genius, and he came to the fore of the Workers' Party, and he ran for president three times, in 1990, where he narrowly lost, and 1994 and 1998, where he lost again, and before finally winning the 2002 elections. And it's a big thing in Brazil, which is a very racially stratified and sort of class-divided society, to have Lula, who got his start as a metal worker and is from the northeast of the country, which is the most impoverished and historically backwards region, or the narrative likes to go, came to Sao Paulo as a boy, got a start in the factories, and now as a president of the country, doesn't have much formal education, doesn't speak like proper formal Portuguese. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's really like the elite hate him for this reason, and still do. And at the same time, he was a remarkably successful president. His party, by the time it came into power, wasn't the radical left force it was, but it was sort of like a moderate social democratic party that pursued macroeconomic orthodoxy along with sort of social policies aimed at helping the poor. They lifted 30 million people out of poverty, the economy boomed, they opened up huge consumer markets everywhere, increased infrastructure spending, and really sort of expanded social citizenship, if you would like, in Brazil. First time you would see black people in airports, in the universities. And this generated a backlash. And there were a number of corruption scandals that hit the Workers' Party. And particularly what you have to understand about Brazilian politics is that the political system is designed and was deliberately designed by the people who drafted the constitution under the influence of the military, who didn't lose like they did in, say, Argentina. They just kind of negotiated the transition and sort of... were the puppet masters behind it, which basically made sure that when the president's elected, the Congress will be divided between an innumerable amount of small parties, which mostly exist for rent-seeking purposes. They're basically like clientelistic parties that have like some strong man out in the middle of nowhere who represents them. And if you want to do policy, you have to negotiate with all these like big machine politicians from the cities, which is atom mafiosos, all these guys from the country who get their kicks from cutting off peasants' arms, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. And so what PT did is, when the Workers' Party, when they came to power, and which had been pioneered by their predecessors in the previous governor, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who's still lauded as this, like, you know, mythical anti-corruption, clean, technocratic, neoliberal president, like kind of the Bill Clinton of Brazil, even though he was kind of discredited by the time he left office, which is
Bill Clinton wasn't considered that clean, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true. That's very true. But like, basically, he thought he was like, Cardoso was like, Bill Clinton's my best buddy, you know?
Right, right, right.
You know, I'm hanging out with Bill Clinton, Tony Blair.
So like a modern kind of neoliberal. Yeah, cool, yeah.
He's also kind of interesting because he was a former professor of sociology, a very famous Marxist professor.
And he still doesn't actually denounce any of his former beliefs. He just says he's been somewhat consistent. But anyway, his party had basically said the way to do politics in Brazil is, and they didn't do this openly, of course, is basically set up institutionalized kickback schemes to ensure that people vote along with you in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the Workers' Party did much the same thing, because that's basically
that's
what you
how had. You do politics.
And unfortunately, if you want to get anything passed, you have to make it. And here's the thing with the corruption. Is like, I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. It's like, there's a trade-off when you come to power in a political system, which is not by your own design, is that do you want to make certain sort of choices to make it be effective, or do you want to sort of be impotent? And the Workers' Party made their choices or did business as usual,
mm-hmm.
and this continued, and everybody was involved in Brazil. And there was a big scandal in 2005 that nearly threatened it, nearly sunk the party, called the Mensalão, which is the monthly kickback scheme. But they survived that, and Lula left office in 2010 with a 84% approval rating, which is kind of unheard of.
Yeah, and it's almost like people don't really care about corruption.
Well, I mean, the economy was booming, things were good.
Yeah,
and then his successor, who he personally nominated, was kind of like a political unknown, but had been a former guerrilla who had been tortured by the dictatorship. Her name is Dilma Rousseff. And she was elected, and she proceeded to do nothing too radical, but go a little bit more to the left with economic policies, counter-cyclical spending to thwart the recession, pursue big infrastructure projects. But at the same time, the Brazil's economy, the international effects of the global recession, Chinese slowdown, a number of factors meant the economy was just about to not do so well.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2013, it was started by actual like autonomous, you know, like leftist activists. There were protests against a increase in bus fares in Sao Paulo. And like wildfire, these protests suddenly just took off. And suddenly there were huge protests, millions on the street all over the country in dozens of cities. And initially, for like the first month or so, and people still on the left kind of have this very rosy image of this first month of like all of these left, and they grew up basically after the governor of Sao Paulo, who was from who's from the PSDB, the Social Democratic Party, which is not social democratic. It's kind of like the most neoliberal Democrats, but more gangster.
Okay.
Anyway, so they sent the police to beat the shit out of protesters, and people just took to the streets in bigger numbers afterwards. But what had initially been like, you know, youth, people in the periphery, like students, like kind of lefty, you know, are we on the streets? Because it was led by autonomous, didn't really have a clear direction. There weren't mm-hmm. like a clear set of leadership. It was like everyone's on the street.
Bus fares, they kind of, yeah.
We don't have like a particular, we're against all parties. We just, everyone can be there. A number of more shady right-wing actors start to join the fray. And backed by Brazil's very right-wing media, like, middle class, the anti-PT, the anti-worker party middle class, and a number of shady organizations came to the fore and kind of took this narrative and twisted it against the Workers' Party
mm-hmm.
to the point that Dilma went from having like, you know, 55, 56 normal poll ratings, I can't remember exactly, to kind of her proof ratings start plummeting. And then the recession starts happening. So by 2014, the economy is not doing so well, and Dilma's approval ratings are like going downhill.
The credibility of the party has been deeply threatened by both economic and sort of these entries into this protest movement. Right?
Yeah, so there's like a big thing and things were coming to the fore. And then in 2014, two things happened. One is the elections, the last elections, and then the beginning of something called Lava Jato, which is this anti-corruption investigation, which we'll get into later. But in the 2014 elections, the Tucanos, or the Social Democratic Party, they call the Tucans in Brazil because of the colors of their flag, you know, very tropical, had this candidate who they said was young, fresh, not reactionary. He's a great modernizer. He's good looking, and his name was Aécio Neves.
Mm.
But Aécio Neves might be the most degenerate politician in Brazil. Like, he's kind of notorious for his love of a certain white powder and being, among other things, caught on tape talking about a helicopter that suddenly appeared on his cousin's ranch with 450 odd kilos of cocaine paste, which is a precursor ingredient to cocaine, and talking about killing his cousin, among other things.
Cool.
Yeah. And there's also like some great videos of like him like being almost like blackout drunk, like stumbling to buy drunk food in the middle of Rio de Janeiro.
Well, whom among us?
Yeah, but I mean, it's the most relatable thing about him, but he's like, he's but yeah, anyway, so
he's a really crooked guy, and yeah,
he's like basically he single-handedly basically destroyed his own party. But anyway, basically in 2014, people didn't know this yet or were ignoring it about Aesio. Aesio also got his sister sent to prison. That's kind of sick.
Damn.
Even his family hates him now.
Damn.
So basically, the center-right thought they were going to win these elections because like everything was moving against the Workers' Party. People were, and what happens with any party is that people get sick of incumbents, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So in 2014, they thought they were going to win, but Dilma moved to the left and ran a pretty strong like anti-austerity, these guys are going to take away your sort of social welfare, and sort of narrowly won. And the center right didn't like this, so they threw their toys out the pram and refused to accept these election results, which started this chain of events really that brought us Bolsonaro. So at the same,
they just demanded
your recount, but nothing really happened. But they basically said we're not going to accept this.
Right.
So at the same time, this anti-corruption investigation, which starts into, it's called car wash, Lava Jato, which starts into investigation, money laundering in a car wash in the southern state of Paraná, and then uncovers through this, and it's like a whole messed up story by itself, which is going to be too complicated to explain, basically a chain of corruption, which includes the state-owned oil company, which is Petrobras, and a bunch of huge construction firms in which politicians, basically they would ensure that the deals that the contracts from the state-owned oil company that went to these huge construction companies would ensure that everyone got kickbacks. So it was a systematized system of kickbacks, and a lot of it was used for like campaign financing, but it was a huge amount of corruption. But the thing is, it involved everyone.
Right.
Like the most indicted parties for Lava Jato in terms of like being involved in it are not Pete is actually quite much lower on the list. But at the same time, it was very clear, and it became increasingly clear as this investigation went on, this investigation was primarily targeting, because it wasn't only the Workers' Party and their allies in right. business and in politics. So it took out a whole bunch of their leadership. It's ended up with Lula, who's in prison. I personally think the charges are quite weak against him. It's like he's supposedly got a bribe in an apartment in a second-rate city, mm-hmm. and in a form
the sort of thing that would have never like been brought up if there weren't this like anti-corruption fervor.
Yeah, and he didn't even live in the apartment. Meanwhile, like ASCO has like God knows how many apartments. The current president Michel Temer has like 20 in the names of all his mistresses.
Wow,
including his English teacher.
Damn.
Yeah, but anyway, so basically what happened is this anti-corruption sentiment, and people were just like, corruption is the biggest problem. These guys are trying to use corruption to turn Brazil into Venezuela mm-hmm. or Cuba. There's a whole bunch of anger, and these big anti-corruption protests happened in 2015, 2016, which from the beginning are very openly right-wing. They take the national flag and start celebrating things like the dictatorship, and like we just hate the left, and it's the mm-hmm. mostly the upper middle class, not only like which are much whiter in Brazil than the majority of the population. Mm-hmm. And they're all saying the Workers' Party needs to go. And this creates, along with Dilma doing one more thing, which is basically breaking with her anti-austerity promises and embracing austerity, mm-hmm. but it still wasn't enough to save her. So with the support of elements of big business, and particularly driven by Brazil's media, which is really one company, Globo, which is kind of like the BBC, if the BBC was a private company in Brazil.
Right.
They had these movements which basically culminated in an impeachment process, which was basically a soft coup, because it was about like they got it for absolutely nothing. It was like moving money around to pay for social welfare, which everyone does in Brazil.
Yeah.
And she was removed in 2016, and then she was replaced by her vice, who's kind of like from a different party, which is the most corrupt party in Brazil, but he's probably the most unpopular politician in the history of polling. He's got approval ratings of less than 2%. And from the beginning,
oh man, that's such an own.
Yeah,
single-digit approval rating. Yeah,
and he's kind of like embraced it. He's like,
there's only one number lower than that.
Yeah, it's within the margin of error of zero. And like Michelle Temer, who people like kind of joke looks like a vampire, like is basically appointed the biggest array of like crooks and gangsters in his supposed regime that was going to be against corruption in Brazil, and did such things as remove anti-slavery laws.
Well, what were they doing with those?
Yeah. All cut workers' rights, cut social spending, blah, blah, blah. But people like were like, these guys are just as corrupt as everyone else. So at the end of the day, the center right, because they've moved against democracy, not only unleashed this like really popular right-wing fervor, which gave birth to Bolsonaro through these anti-corruption protests, and I will get into that a little bit later, and discredited themselves entirely and into the void left on the right, because the majority of Bolsonaro voters would just be voting for a center-right candidate in normal elections. Mm-hmm. People are like, hey, why don't we try this guy?
Yeah, at least something new and fresh.
Something new and fresh. Just to give you an array, I think chapel listeners will kind of enjoy this. So his party, which is called the Party of Social Liberalism, there's nothing socially liberal about them, went from being like a non-entity to the second biggest party in Brazil. And among the people who elected were three of Bolsonaro's four fail sons. He has three.
Fantastic. I love a political fail son.
Eduardo, who's like the most well-known of these fail sons, is kind of in hot water for threatening to... He's saying that if the Supreme Court ever messed with him, he would send a corporal and a private and they could close down the court. No problems. And also elected was another great fail son in Brazil, which is the most prominent descendant of Brazil's monarchy, who has reinvented himself as kind of like right-wing, like, you know, minor celebrity who writes books like Why is Brazil So Backwards? Probably because of your family, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Alexandre Frota, who is an ex-porn star and soap actor, who, among other things, also made gay porn, but has reinvented himself as a defender of family values and moral virtue, even though he's on record boasting about raping a black woman.
Right, yeah.
I mean, like, even, like, just give you an example of, like, the fail-son dynamic here. Is Bolsonaro's one son, Flavio, was elected as a city councilor in Rio at 17. And the reason this happened was because Bolsonaro was currently going through a divorce with his wife at the time, and who was also a city councilor, and he thought it'd be cool to run her son against her and take her off the council that way.
Wow.
And anyway.
Brazilian politics are so cool.
Oh, fucking depressing. But anyway, and then also a... And this is, again, something that Chapo listeners will have encountered in the United States. A cop who got famous for killing someone on camera.
Right.
Anyway, that's the short story.
This is the short story of how we ended up here, where there's going to be a literal fascist in charge of a large country. And again, a literal fascist. I know people like to pretend that, you know, the Proud Boys are brown shirts when actually they're MS-13 for Rose Emoji Twitter. But there is such a thing as literal fascism, and it is coming to Brazil.
Yeah, and they even have a dance routine.
Wait, what?
Yeah, there's like, first of all, there was a dance routine that was invented for...
But that's deeply Weimar. Yeah, yeah.
For the the anti-corruption protests. And then they've sort of made it more part of the Bolsonaro campaign. And the other thing is people like to do at protests is like do push-ups. So there's all these videos, because Bolsonaro, before he got stabbed, because I don't think he's a little bit, he got stabbed by some crazy and then they blamed the left for it at a rally. And he's been kind of like recovering ever since. But anyway, like before that, he used to like do push-ups at these rallies. But the thing is, if you watch these videos, he can't do a real push-up.
Wow.
It's like kind of like he's self-cucking.
Yeah.
It's weird as shit.
A really bad cell phone.
But yeah. People love that shit.
They love it?
Yeah, they love the push-ups, and then they also love, and like it's also a great video, and again, it's kind of, it would be funny if he wasn't about to rule a major country and kill a lot of people, where he's like with his fucking frenzied supporters of who are basically like Brazilian frat bros.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like when fascism has arrived in Brazil partially through like off-duty cops and who have formed like sort of like mafia-like paramilitary organizations who kill people and take over like areas in Rio, and partially because a bunch of like dudes who drink a lot of whey and have like big unathletic muscles,
right?
And really are into like, you know, like, I'm sick of the feminists, tell me what to do.
Yeah, it's vanity muscle guys.
Wearing the Brazilian football shirt and their wives. And also the evangelicals, because those fuckers are everywhere.
Yeah.
And anyway, he tried to stage dive once and they didn't catch him. He fell.
Oh, it's sad. It's going to be so bad. But also that's funny. That's a funny thing that happened.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, the problem with this is like, I've broken Godwin's law, but actually Godwin even intervened in this and said, yeah, you can use... inventor of Godwin's law endorsed Fernando Haddad, who is the PT candidate against Bolsonaro, which is just...
Right.
This is where we are in 2018.
It's like, look, I'm concerned. Yeah.
Things are not going right. But anyway, like, I think, you know, there was like this sort of comedic and cartoonish aspect to things in like 1920s Italy or 1930s Germany too.
Yeah, it was probably very wacky right up until the point... I mean, who knows? Maybe it was the violence was also incredibly wacky. Goose-stepping is pretty slapstick.
Yeah, and then they had like the SA was having all like the, you know, like the brown shirts had these weird orgies and shit.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, that was the weird thing. People tend to think of authoritarianism as like very like socially conservative in like a formalized way. And it's like, no, man, fascists party.
Yeah, they party hard, but in like especially in Brazil. But at the same time, like the other thing behind like Bolsonaro's rise has been these crazy. Like in Brazil, your entire social life, maybe your work life, everything happens through WhatsApp, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about WhatsApp is like everybody's on WhatsApp from crazy grandma to your like degenerate cousin, and they're all in the same family WhatsApp group. And like basically the fake news.
So like more than Facebook. It's their Facebook.
It's no, people are on Facebook too, but WhatsApp is big. Because basically people don't text. People use WhatsApp.
Okay.
People get everything through WhatsApp. If you don't call people, you use WhatsApp.
Okay.
So like basically it turns out like a bunch of nice upstanding Brazilian businessmen have using illegal campaign financing have set up all these, and we're still unclear to what degree this has happened, these dodgy WhatsApp projects where they just filled Brazil's WhatsApp space through of like the most bizarre array of fake news possible, which has had a big role in this. Basically, a lot of people think that the Workers' Party is like a combination between the Sinaloa cartel, Satan, and high Stalinist Russia. And some of the stories that are going around is like that the Workers' Party wants to give like kindergarten kids a gay kit. Turn them gay, but they want to teach them gender ideology.
Yeah,
and the best part of it is like the big thing is they showed as evidence is like this.
That's
fucking,
very American.
It's very American.
Thing. Like they're going to teach our kids gender.
Bruh, the cultural Marxism, all of this shit.
Yeah.
It's big in Brazil.
Yeah, and,
like they had the big evidence was like this baby bottle with like a dick shaped teat on the top, and people like sending it around in groups. This is evidence of what the PT is up to.
Wow.
And some people actually believe that, which is I mean,
the WhatsApp group is lit.
Yeah, it's lit. It's lit. And then crazy grandma is like, oh, you know, like there's an alliance between Satan and Haddadji and he's a pedophile.
Uh-huh.
And then like people are like, oh yeah, fuck those guys. And, you know, civil discourse, as the liberals like to say, disappeared. And then the other weird thing about this, and we move on more to our corruption, and this is really like, I think the last thing to say, is that basically the most educated upper middle class professional sections of Brazil, basically I think it would be fair to say a lot of the same people who in the United States would be very enthusiastic Hillary Clinton voters are all voting for Bolsonaro or abstaining.
Right.
Because they're like, at least he's not a communist and he's not corrupt.
Right, right. So now we know kind of how we got here a little bit. But what I really wanted to talk about was your Jacobin article against anti-corruption. So this is a sly little thing you did here. People are like, what? Does that mean you're in favor of corruption? So let's like first start out with what a good working definition of corruption is.
Well, the thing is like corruption is actually kind of hard to define. And it's, I mean, I don't want to sound too pretentious, but I am a PhD student.
So you are pretentious.
Yeah, I can't hide it too much. But anyway, like blah, blah, blah. Basically, like corruption's been around since ancient Greeks. Dudes like Aristotle were talking about that shit. Machiavelli was talking about that shit. It's been like a constant of political theory for quite a while now.
Right.
But the thing is, corruption's meaning has changed over time and it means different things in different contexts. So like back in the day, corruption used to mean like, you know, like some sort of form of social degeneration where people have a lost faith in civic virtue, the order of things is breaking down, and some sort of form of moral renewal was needed. And it was seen as like not just a set of specific exchanges, but like a broader social process which affected the health of the republic. And there was a sort of understanding that corruption was not just a, it was a deep problem that required a big political project and to turn around. And then more recently, corruption has been taken to mean, let me actually just read from my piece, because I think I have the World Bank definition over here. Okay, the World Bank defines corruption as behavior or behaviors that break with rules governing public officials regarding the pursuit of private interests, such as wealth, power, or status. And I think the two crucial things to notice is this rarely refers to public power. It doesn't refer to private actors. And it also kind of has the sense that it's like specific things are definable. When right. what would be considered a things that are private interests, when does that become like something that's illicit?
Right.
Like when, you know, like everyone has private interests. Yeah. When is it a bad thing?
So like lobbying yeah. would be like, that's something that is completely legal in American politics.
But in other places, it's completely seen as corruption.
Right.
So, I mean, I more or less view corruption in like two real ways. And again, this is a working project. So I think it's something that the left has to really tackle and we have to move on. It's tough. But one is, it's kind of like a set of illicit exchanges, which has a way of bring together certain actors in which basically instead of doing it through formal means, favors or money is exchanged for influence, for operating in a certain way, for redistribution. And I think it's more like you have to see it as not like behaviors, but a sort of almost a form of informal regulation of how institutions and function. And this can include private actors.
Mm-hmm.
as well, because I think private actors have an actual interest in corrupting the state. And the second way I view of corruption is it's a political strategy. So basically, this can be seen in two ways. One, it's a political strategy in which basically capital, private actors, when they cannot influence the state directly and through like legal lobbying or mm-hmm. People aren't doing things, they can use the funds to basically buy off members of the ruling party or whoever's in power to do what they want through giving them a nice vacation to a brothel or buying them dinner or giving them like a billion in cash money.
Right.
And the second thing, it's also a way, but it's also a set of way of institutional practices in which like corruption is the way things get done, because the way things get done is things that get traded behind closed doors, and this is just what how institutions function. And there's right. always a set of informal logics. And I think my view is that often it can be a deliberate strategy to make sure that things are corrupt to prevent certain political things from happening. So if you basically, for instance, it's like that boring old saying that power corrupts.
Right.
But if you get into government, you have to govern certain institutions,
mm-hmm.
and these institutions may function on like informal forms of regulation that require a few backhanders, some bribes, that sort of thing. Or if you need business support, you might have to like give them some favors. And what that does is it means that if you want to get things done, you have to adapt to the state and the institutions that comprise the state to such a way that you get your hands dirty, and it prevents you from doing certain more radical things, and also like kind of makes you adapt to power and makes you less of a threat. And I think there's evidence to see in certain cases that things are deliberate this way. It's not just like some story since some dude ate an apple and got all like sinful, that every time I'm gonna get power, I'm gonna get corrupt.
Right. Okay. But one of the things that confused me about the way anti-corruption stuff was utilized in this sort of fascist campaign was how poorly accusations of corruption tend to play generally with working class people. So, for example, I used this example of like my friend Mike, who was a garbage man. And when he would get a job to do large garbage pickup, he would say, I'm going to write you a dummy receipt. Well, he wouldn't say, I'm going to write you a dummy receipt. He would say, you get 15% off if you pay in cash. And then he would write them a dummy receipt and tell the boss that they canceled. Mm-hmm. To like normal people, that makes Mike a working class hero. To a certain kind of person, that makes him like a scurrilous,
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess my question, I guess I sort of answered it. Like, who does this anti-corruption appeal to and why?
Well, I think there's different forms of anti-corruption. And I think this is the crucial thing here. And this is kind of why we have to be so skeptical of its use on the left. And the first thing is to say that there's very few people who actually would ever say they're for corruption, you know?
Right.
Like, I mean, it's not like, name a corrupt politician. Well, there are examples. And right. I have respect for the examples. Like,
With the stuff, though, like with Trump, when they're like, he's not, you know, doing his tax returns, people are like, no, we don't care.
Well, the thing is, like, with the Trump and the tax returns is actually an important thing, is that, like, because corruption is only the state. Mm-hmm. When the businessman doesn't pay his taxes,
right.
He's just being a smart businessman because he's forced to be corrupt by the
the
bureaucrats in Washington,
state.
the red tape.
They're forcing his hand. You know, the rules are unfair.
Yeah, and that's kind of like the way that people see a lot of these things. It's like, for instance, there's like a famous, is two or three, but like the most famous one I think is in Brazil is called Paulo Maluf, who was a infamous governor and mayor of Sao Paulo. State and the city, and his slogan, which is Obama's Faixa in Portuguese, which is he robs but he gets things done.
He's our guy.
He builds some houses.
I want someone who's corrupt on my behalf.
There's a sort of logic to that. Like, you know, if you have to choose between like as a working class guy, like some sort of like neoliberal who's going like, I'm gonna be clean but I'm gonna take your welfare, mm-hmm. and some dude is like, you know, I might steal a bit. I might have a good time, you know?
Yeah.
I like the good whiskey. I don't like that well whiskey.
Right.
I'm going to go build you some houses. I'll make sure you get your families looked after.
Of course.
And it's just a trade-off. But moreover, I think the thing with anti-corruption is there's two ways. It's like the first way is technocratic anti-corruption, which I think it's a relatively recent thing. People don't realize that corruption wasn't like a big thing in terms of international development policy or aid discourse or any of those things until the 90s. It's a real post-Cold War thing. And I think part of it is because like people couldn't explain the failure of like neoliberal structural adjustment policies to develop like third world countries. And like, why were they all so broke? And why is everything not working?
Sure, yeah.
It's because they're corrupt. They've got corrupt cultures. They're not modern.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's like also this idea, which is also kind of neoliberal, that all like forms of like a bigger state means more corruption, which is like mm-hmm. definitely anti-left. And there's also like something to say about like any redistributive politics will be corrupted by men because men suck, which is kind of like straight anti-leftism in these conclusions. And so basically what this means is like we're going to set up a bunch of what counts as corruption and international standards mm-hmm. and measures, which are basically to promote the interests of capital.
Right.
So what corruption is like often taken to be is like this form of transparency in which you basically operate to accepted standards, which makes it easy for capital to come in and out, and power gets taken away from like elected officials and given to sort of technocrats who are more favorable to the interests of capital.
Right. So, which is argued to be less of a conflict of interest somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also like this whole idea that corruption can be solved by technical fixes. We just need people right. who do not polluted by ideology and power. And like think of it like the Democrats here discourse about corruption, or like I hate to use words, when they talk about corruption, they talk about we need technical fixes to solve the stuff.
Right.
Even though they're as embedded in these same networks of money, while on the right, you have something which I would call like populist anti-corruption. Mm-hmm. And the thing with corruption is you can stand in for anger about a whole bunch of things, like loss of power, you know, like crime in your neighborhood, things that feel intrinsically unfair.
Right. It manifests in their head as this idea of, well, the problem is corruption.
The problem is bad people in power. And if it's the system and everyone's bad,
right.
we need somebody to clean it up.
Right. And Brazil does have a lot of problems.
Yeah, as does the United States.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I think Trump actually ran on an anti-corruption platform.
I think that's fair. I remember, like, what about Hillary's emails? Yeah, drain the swamp. Yeah, that kind of thing. And people are like, oh, my life is miserable because there are people corrupt. Yeah.
And, like, the thing is, like, he's obviously, like, an incredibly corrupt man.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
As well as, like,
the Republicans. But people think he's going to be corrupt for them.
Yeah, and also, like, the Republicans are, like, you know, who's that dude that, like, lobbyist? Jack Abramoff.
Yeah.
I watched that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looked like he had a sick party.
Yeah, of course, yeah. That's the other thing is they look appealing and they look more fun than, like, nerds.
And also, like,
yeah,
they have, like, no scruples. Like, I'm going to work for Apartheid South Africa. That's sick. Anyway, yeah. but the point is, like, basically this anti, like, Washington discourse, like, Washington's corrupt. The problem is all these bureaucrats. We're going to get clean them all out. But it's just, like, moralistic posturing. It's not, like, a clear program. It's,
yeah.
It's, like, basically...
But it appeals to people's kind of libidinal excitement.
Yeah. Libidinal excitement and this idea that... you know, like there's a Masonic cleansing, but it's always like this guy who's kind of outside of politics, whether it's, you know, the dude who put up these Gaudi towers and eats well-done steaks, Donald Trump, or like this, you know, fascist ex-captain who's in Brazil, who's been in like government for 27 years and really hasn't done shit and has done all the same things other people do. There's always like somebody, an outsider, to come in and cleanse it. And I think the second thing is why... And these both tend to be quite right-wing and anti-democratic because it's like we're going to shoot our way out of problems. We're going to have like turn against institutions and accountability because that's a problem with...
A cleansing reign,
Or it's like, you know, we're going to give power to a bunch of technocrats who are, you know, not exactly in favor of democracy or working class interests. And then the other effect of like all of this anti-corruption talk, and this is where it really makes it hard for the left, and I think it's probably the most dangerous thing about it is that... it makes people cynical. It removes faith in public life or the idea that politics and political activism and mobilization can get things, can change things.
It's it suggests that the idea of the institutions themselves, so stripping, you know, some like programs and, you know, making kind of like what you would consider like bare bones, small government. It's a good excuse for that.
And more of it's like, basically like put it this way, the left has the burden of like convincing people that things can change, and to make things change, you need to get off your ass and get involved in something, which might require some sacrifices. But when like people see like we've done all this work, we've got the center left government, but they also corrupt, they do the same things as other guys. It's like, I'm just going to look after me and my own, which is kind of a natural human instinct. And the thing is, that's all the right needs. Like,
right.
It all needs is like people to sit on their asses and look after their own. But I'm not saying it's completely normal to want that, and most people are going to do that anyway. But like, it basically, they don't need to mobilize people to win.
Right.
They just need to make, and this degree of like demoralization and dissatisfaction like undermines the left or people's belief in the possibilities of social change. And I think that's kind of what you've seen in Brazil. And I think the thing is, what my argument, at least in what I've been trying to say, is that this is a something which is weaponized against left-wing projects. And what you also have is like when you finally a left-wing government does come to power, you often have this thing, this sort of narrative is like, you know, they failed that for whatever reason, from like the PT in Brazil to Mitterrand in France, or whoever you want to choose. And the reason they failed is because they betrayed the working class.
Right.
It's kind of like when they didn't have the right ideas, the right leaders, they betrayed that. And it's basically the same anti-corruption discourse of the right. So like basically it's moralism. It doesn't offer solutions. It doesn't actually look what the problems with corruption are. And it tends to empower right-wing projects and undermine.
It seems like a one-sided weapon, honestly. Like when the right uses it, it can very effectively crush left-wing movements. And when the left uses it, or well, when liberals use it, it just, you know, it's a fart in a hurricane. Like no one gives a shit.
Well, I think it's like it does work, but it also sets up double standards because like everyone expects
it. Didn't work here.
But like I think the reason why it's like it doesn't really work in the same way, and it has worked in other places because like, you know, attacking the corrupt elites, the standard of like left wing rhetoric.
Yeah.
But
they tend to it works best when they attack them on politics rather than whether they're sleazy or not.
I agree, but like in the case, I think it's fundamentally, I don't think the right wing politics see any problem with actual corruption because for them it's like a zero sum game. Like all like public life is going to be corrupt, and we just have to keep the other guys out of power. So whatever we do is justified in either like some sort of ideological crusade or like some sort of shared belief in that basically like all the things that we believe in, like social programs. Okay, I'm going to sound like very like liberal left rather than saying like redistribution of like basically workers' power over capital. But basically, like, you know, like reformist social programs mm-hmm. are just corruption itself. It's just ways of like buying off working class votes.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have the same double standard as I think.
Yeah, they are. I mean, like that is what it is. Like we will give you welfare so you will vote for us. That is not an exchange that I consider to be a bad one.
Yeah, like, but for them, they think it's like that's what real corruption
right,
is.
Right, right.
So like
there's a conflict of interest there. Yeah.
So like when the upper middle class took to the streets in Brazil, for instance, they weren't necessarily just angry about the fact there was a bunch of dodgy spending going on where politicians were getting millions from like the state oil company and big companies. It was like the Workers' Party had fundamentally upset the natural order by like saying your domestic worker is going to get paid a minimum wage,
mm-hmm.
you know, or like black people should probably get some spaces at the universities, or like, you know, this idea that like there's an intrusion that people have got to their places not because of merit but because of unfair advantages, and that for them is corruption.
Right.
So you can see in this way like class hate and then racism and other things can get all entwined in this nasty mess, which is just it's against corruption. So you can be mm-hmm. a nice citizen, you know, protesting against corruption on Avenida Paulista, but really you just want the police to go kill like thousands of black people. And like your domestic worker to never be paid again.
Right.
And that's the extreme example. But at the same time, the challenge I think for us is that like when the left inherits this battle over corruption, and corruption is like a central theme of politics seemingly everywhere right now, we tend to adopt the moralistic rhetoric of like, you know, there's bad people in power. Let's get them out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, what we're going to do when we get in power and then find out we have to adapt to the institutions that we are. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try and change the institutions or have more radical programs that actually, you know, change the structure of the state to create more possibilities for left-wing advances. But I'm just saying you set yourself the trap of like, you get called out for corruption very soon.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the challenge then is for like socialists and those of us on the left is to imagine, I mean, I'm like what an actual anti-corruption politics would look like in the sense of like, I don't necessarily think it has to be anti-corruption in like we against corruption. This is an anti-corruption program. It has to be that the problem with corruption is it's another way of elites ensuring that their own interests are being looked after.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another form of exploitation within society. So what we need to do is we need to break the powers of the ruling class through creating, you know, trade union movements, reforms that expand democracy, through changing the way the, you know, forms of power in society. So my argument finally is basically like, and again, this is kind of still on the developing stage, and I think there's a lot of debate to it, but the challenge that we have to do a better job of dealing with this issue in terms of like saying it's about politics and we have to build a political project that goes against capital and the forces that protect capital, rather than saying that it's a problem of bad people in power and that at the end of the day, you know, we just need good people. We need who have the correct line, who are right. not going to betray us when we win power.
Right, right. Yeah, sounds pretty good. So let's get on that. Let's just, you know, start working on that after lunch.
Well, in the meantime, I feel like I'm going to just drown my sorrows for this terrible election.
Yeah, buddy. We've been friends a while. Maybe consider not going back to Weimar, Brazil. It's not looking good.
I'll be fine. Everyone else is gonna be fucked.
Well,
you know, the one thing I know.
Maybe he'll get stabbed again.
Oh yeah, I mean maybe, but the one relief that I have, and again, it's kind of funny to be talking about this in a podcast. As somebody who's kind of known for being active on the left, it's that like these dudes don't read stuff. And I definitely don't read stuff in English.
There you go. So you're safe.
I'm safe, and I'm also white as fuck.
Yeah. Enjoy that. All right. Thanks very much, Ben Fogel. We will link to both that article, your article in Catalyst about Brazil, and my appearance on your podcast, Auf Bunga Bunga. Which has a stupid German portmanteau of a name, but is nonetheless probably my favorite politics podcast.
Yeah. For those who don't listen to us, we talk a lot about global politics, about ideas, theories, and theory, but mostly about like the crisis of the contemporary political order and the awful despair that everyone's facing right now. It's cheery, it's good, and we have some really good guests, and we you should check it out.
All right. Thanks so much.